Chapter 8, Empire of Persia and Media, Xerxes, the Army of Invasion. Xerxes was that fourth king after Cyrus referred to by the angel in Daniel 11, verse 2, who should be far richer than all three of his predecessors, and who by his strength through his riches should stir up all against the realm of Grecia. He describes himself thus, "I am Xerxes, the great king, the king of kings, the king of the lands where many languages are spoken, the king of this wide earth, afar and near, the son of King Darius the Achaemenian." The events of the last days of Darius, as recorded in the preceding chapter, are a sufficient explanation why he should desire, and even why it was necessary, to stir up all against the realm of Grecia. First, however, in the year following the death of Darius, 484 B.C., he marched against those who had revolted from him, and having reduced them and laid all Egypt under a far harder yoke than ever his father had put upon it, he gave the government to Achaemenes, who was his own brother and son to Darius. After Egypt was subdued, Xerxes, being about to take in hand the expedition against Athens, called together an assembly of the noblest Persians to learn their opinions and to lay before them his own designs. This was the third year of Xerxes, and this assembly was the one referred to in Esther 1, verses 1 to 4. In those days, when the king Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan the palace, in the third year of his reign, he made a feast unto all his princes and his servants. The power of Persia and Media, the nobles and princes of the provinces, being before him, when he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the honor of his excellent majesty many days, even 180 days. The Hebrew Ahasuerus is the natural equivalent of the old Persian Kesharsha, the true name of the monarch called by the Greeks Xerxes, as now read in his inscriptions. Only a few inscriptions of Xerxes have been found, and all these unimportant. The only real resulting fact is the name of the king, Kesharsha, which proves to be identical with the Ahasuerus of Holy Scripture. After much counsel, deliberation, and debating pro and con, Xerxes was inclined to change his mind and make no expedition at all against Greece, but by several dreams was finally confirmed in carrying on his enterprise. The great question being at last decided, and the governors, nobles, and princes being about to return to their provinces to gather the levies of troops, Xerxes closed the assembly with a grand banquet, the account of which well illustrates the great riches of this king. And when these days were expired, the king made a feast unto all the people that were present in Shushan the palace, both unto great and small, 7 days in the court of the garden of the king's palace, where were white, green, and blue hangings fastened with cords of fine linen and purple to silver rings and pillars of marble. The beds were of gold and silver, upon a pavement of red and blue and white and black marble. And they gave them drink in vessels of gold, the vessels being diverse one from another, and royal wine in abundance according to the state of the king. And the drinking was according to the law. None did compel. For so the king had appointed to all the officers of his house that they should do according to every man's pleasure. Also Vashti, the queen, made a feast for the women in the royal house which belonged to King Ahasuerus. Reckoning from the recovery of Egypt, Xerxes spent 4 full years in collecting his host and making ready all things that were needful for his soldiers. It was not till the close of the 5th year, 481 BC, that he set forth on his march, accompanied by a mighty multitude. For of all the armaments whereof any mention has reached us, this was by far the greatest, insomuch that no other expedition compared to this seems of any account. For was there a nation in all Asia which Xerxes did not bring with him against Greece? Or was there a river except those of unusual size which sufficed for his troops to drink? One nation furnished ships, another was arrayed among the foot soldiers, a third had to supply horses, a fourth transports for the horse and men likewise for the service, a fifth ships of war toward the bridges, a sixth ships and provisions. And so Xerxes gathered together his host, ransacking every corner of the continent. Remembering the disaster to the fleet of Darius on attempting to double the Cape of Mount Athos, Xerxes determined not to run any such risk, but rather to cut a canal through the land to the north of Mount Athos, and by that to conduct his fleet safely toward Greece. It seems to have taken about a year to make this canal. Meantime, the land forces from all parts of the empire were gathering at Sardis, that city having been appointed as their place of rendezvous. As soon as Xerxes himself had arrived at Sardis, his first care was to send off heralds into Greece who were to prefer a demand for earth and water and to require that preparation should be made everywhere to feast the king. To Athens, indeed, and to Sparta, he sent no such demand, but these cities accepted. His messengers went everywhere. Now the reason why he sent for earth and water to states which had already refused was this. He thought that although they had refused when Darius made the demand, they would now be too frightened to venture to say him nay. So he sent his heralds, wishing to know for certain how it would be. One of the essential preparations for his expedition was to build a bridge of boats over the straits. Midway between Sestos and Miletus in the Hellespontine Chersonese, and right over against Abydos, there is rocky tongue of land, runs out for some distance into the sea. Toward this tongue of land, then, the men to whom the business was assigned carried out a double bridge from Abydos. And while the Phoenicians constructed one line with cables of white flax, the Egyptians in the other used ropes made of papyrus. Now it is 7 furlongs across from Abydos to the opposite coast. When, therefore, the channel had been bridged successfully, it happened that a great storm arising broke the whole work to pieces and destroyed all that had been done. When Xerxes heard of the loss of his bridge, he was full of wrath and straightway gave orders that the Hellespont should receive 300 lashes and that a pair of fetters should be cast into it. Nay, I have even heard it said that he had the branders take their irons and therewith brand the Hellespont. It is certain that he commanded those who scourged the waters to utter as they lashed them these barbarian and wicked words, "Thou bitter water, thy Lord lays on thee this punishment because thou hast wronged him without a cause, having suffered no evil at his hands. Verily, King Xerxes will cross thee, whether thou wilt or no. Well dost thou deserve that no man should honor thee with sacrifice, for thou art of a truth a treacherous and unsavory river." While the sea was thus punished by his orders, he likewise commanded that the overseers of the work should lose their heads. Then they, whose business it was, executed the unpleasing task laid upon them, and other master builders were set over the work, who accomplished it in the way which I will now describe. They joined together triremes and pentaconters, 360, to support the bridge on the side of the Euxine Sea, and 314 to sustain the other. And these they placed at right angles to the sea, and in the direction of the current of the Hellespont, relieving by these means the tension of the shore cables. Having joined the vessels, they moored them with anchors of unusual size, that the vessels of the bridge toward the Euxine might resist the winds which blow from within the straits, and that those of the more western bridge facing the Aegean might withstand the winds which set in from the south and from the southeast. A gap was left in the penteconters in no fewer than three places to afford a passage for such light crafts as chose to enter or leave the Euxine. When all this was done, they made the cables taut from the shore by the help of wooden capstans. This time, moreover, instead of using the two materials separately, they assigned to each bridge six cables, two of which were of white flax, while four were of papyrus. Both cables were of the same size and quality, but the flaxen were the heavier, weighing not less than a talent, the cubit. When the bridge across the channel was thus complete, trunks of trees were sawn into planks which were cut to the width of the bridge, and these were laid side by side upon the tightened cables and then fastened on the top. This done, brushwood was brought and arranged upon the planks, after which earth was heaped upon the brushwood and the whole trodden down into a solid mass. Lastly, a bulwark was set up on either side of this causeway, of such a height as to prevent the sumpter beasts and the horses from seeing over it and taking fright at the water. And now when all was prepared, the bridges and the works at Athos, the breakwaters about the mouths of the cutting, which were made to hinder the surf from blocking up the entrances, and the cutting itself. And when the news came to Xerxes that this last was completely finished, then at length the host, having first wintered at Sardis, began its march toward Abydos, fully equipped on the first approach of spring. First of all went the baggage-bearers and the sumpter beasts, and then a vast crowd of many nations mingled together without any intervals, amounting to more than one half of the army. After these troops, an empty space was left to separate between them and the king. In front of the king went first 1,000 horsemen, picked men of the Persian nation, then spearmen 1,000, likewise chosen troops with their spearheads pointing toward the ground, next 10 of the sacred horses called Nisaean, all daintily caparisoned. Now these horses are called Nisaean because they come from the Nisaean plain, a vast flat in Media, producing horses of unusual size. After the 10 sacred horses came the holy chariot of Jupiter, drawn by 8 milk-white steeds, with the charioteer on foot behind them holding the reins, for no mortal is ever allowed to mount into the car. Next to this came Xerxes himself, riding in a chariot drawn by Nisaean horses, with his charioteer Patarambhes, the son of Atanes, a Persian, standing by his side. Thus rode forth Xerxes from Sardis, but he was accustomed every now and then, when the fancy took him, to alight from his chariot and travel in a litter. Immediately behind the king there followed a body of 1,000 spearmen, the noblest and bravest of the Persians, holding their lances in the usual manner. Then came 1,000 Persian horse, picked men, then 10,000, picked also after the rest, and serving on foot. Of these last, 1,000 carried spears with golden pomegranates at their lower end instead of spikes, and these encircled the other 9,000, who bore on their spears pomegranates of silver. The spearmen, too, who pointed their lances toward the ground, had golden pomegranates, and the 1,000 Persians who followed close after Xerxes had golden apples. behind the 10,000 footmen came a body of Persian cavalry, likewise 10,000, after which there was again a void space for as much as 2 furlongs, and then the rest of the army followed in a confused crowd. When he had arrived at Abydos, Xerxes wished to look upon all his host. So, as there was a throne of white marble upon a hill near the city, which they of Abydos had prepared beforehand by the king's bidding for his especial use, Xerxes took his seat on it, and gazing thence upon the shore below, beheld at one view all his land forces and all his ships. While thus employed, he felt a desire to behold a sailing match among his ships, which accordingly took place and was won by the Phoenicians of Sidon, much to the joy of Xerxes, who was delighted alike with the race and with his army. And now, as he looked and saw the whole Hellespont covered with the vessels of his fleet, and all the shore and every plain about Abydos as full as could be of men, Xerxes congratulated himself on his good fortune, but after a little while he wept. Being asked why he wept, he replied, "There came upon me a sudden pity when I thought of the shortness of man's life, and considered that of all this host, so numerous as it is, not one will be alive when 100 years are gone by." All that day the preparations for the passage continued, and on the morrow they burnt all kinds of spices upon the bridges, and strewed the way with myrtle boughs, while they waited anxiously for the sun, which they hoped to see as he rose. And now the sun appeared, and Xerxes took a golden goblet, and poured from it a libation into the sea, praying, the while with his face turned to the sun, that no misfortune might befall him such as to hinder his conquest of Europe until he had penetrated to its uttermost boundaries. After he had prayed, he cast the golden cup into the Hellespont, and with it a golden bowl and a Persian sword of the kind which they call Akanasis. I cannot say for certain whether it was as an offering to the sun god that he threw these things into the deep, or whether he repented of having scourged the Hellespont, and thought by his gifts to make amends to the sea for what he had done. When, however, his offerings were made, the army began to cross, and the foot soldiers with the horsemen passed over by one of the bridges, that namely which lay toward the Euxine, while the sumpter beasts and the camp followers passed by the other, which looked on the Aegean. Foremost went the 10,000 Persians, all wearing garlands upon their heads, and after them a mixed multitude of many nations. These crossed upon the first day. On the next day the horsemen began the passage, and with them went the soldiers who carried their spears with the point downward, garlanded like the 10,000. Then came the sacred horses and the sacred chariot. Next Xerxes with his lancers and the 1,000 horse, then the rest of the army. At the same time the ships sailed over to the opposite shore. According, however, to another account which I have heard, the king crossed the last. As soon as Xerxes had reached the European side, he stood to contemplate his army as they crossed under the lash, and the crossing continued during 7 days and 7 nights without rest or pause. What the exact number of the troops of each nation was, I cannot say with certainty, for it is not mentioned by anyone, but the whole land army together was found to amount to 1,700,000 men. The manner in which the numbering took place was the following. A body of 10,000 men were brought to a certain place, and the men were made to stand as close together as possible, after which a circle was drawn around them, and the men were let go. Then, where the circle had been, a fence was built about the height of a man's middle, and the enclosure was filled continually with fresh troops, till the whole army had in this way been numbered. When the numbering was over, the troops were drawn up according to their several nations. Now these were the nations that took part in this expedition. The Persians, who wore on their heads the soft hat called the tiara, and about their bodies tunics with sleeves of divers colors, having iron scales upon them like the scales of a fish. Their legs were protected by trousers, and they bore wicker shields for bucklers, their quivers hanging at their backs, and their arms being a short spear, a bow of uncommon size, and arrows of reed. They had likewise daggers suspended from their girdles along their right thighs. The Medes had exactly the same equipment as the Persians, and indeed the dress common to both is not so much Persian as Median. They had for commander Tigranes of the race of the Achaemenids. These Medes were called anciently by all the people Arians, but when Medea the Colchian came to them from Athens, they changed their name. Such is the account which they themselves give. The Sicyans were equipped in the Persian fashion, except in one respect. They wore on their heads, instead of hats, fillets. The Hyrcanians were likewise armed in the same way as the Persians. The Assyrians went to war with helmets upon their heads made of brass and plated in a strange fashion which is not easy to describe. They carried shields, lances, and daggers very like the Egyptian, but in addition they had wooden clubs knotted with iron and linen corselets. These people, whom the Greeks call Syrians, are called Assyrians by the barbarians. The Chaldeans served in their ranks. The Bactrians went to the war wearing a headdress very like the Median, but armed with bows of cane after the custom of their country, and with short spears. The Saci, or Scythes, were clad in trousers, and had on their heads tall, stiff caps rising to a point. They bore the bow of their country and the dagger, besides which they carried the battle axe, or sagaris. They were, in truth, Amergian Scythians, but the Persians called them Saci, since that is the name they gave to all Scythians. The Indians wore cotton dresses and carried bows of cane and arrows also of cane, with iron at the point. The Arians carried Median bows, but in other respects were equipped like the Bactrians. The Parthians and Chorasmians, with the Sogdians and Gandarians, and the Datica, had the Bactrian equipment in all respects. The Caspians were clad in cloaks of skin and carried the cane bow of their country and the scimitar. So equipped they went to the war. The Sarangians had dyed garments which showed brightly and buskins which reached to the knee. They bore Median bows and lances. The Pactians wore cloaks of skin and carried the bow of their country and the dagger. The Eudians, the Mycians, and the Pericanians were all equipped like the Pactians. The Arabians wore the zira, or long cloak, fastened about them with a girdle, and carried at their right side long bows which, when unstrung, bent backward. The Ethiopians were clothed in the skins of leopards and lions, and had long bows made of the stem of the palm leaf, not less than 4 cubits in length. On these they laid short arrows made of reed, and armed at the tip, not with iron, but with a piece of stone, sharpened to a point, of the kind used in engraving seals. They carried likewise spears, the head of which was the sharpened horn of an antelope, and in addition they had knotted clubs. When they went into battle, they painted their bodies, half with chalk and half with vermilion. The eastern Ethiopians, for 2 nations of this name served in the army, were marshaled with the Indians. They differed in nothing from the other Ethiopians, save in their language and the character of their hair. For the eastern Ethiopians have straight hair, while they of Libya are more woolly-haired than any other people in the world. Their equipment was in most points like that of the Indians, but they wore upon their heads the scalps of horses, with the ears and mane attached. The ears were made to stand upright, and the mane served as a crest. For shields, this people made use of the skins of cranes. The Libyans wore a dress of leather and carried javelins made hard in the fire. The Paphlagonians went to the war with plated helmets upon their heads and carrying small shields and spears of no great size. They had also javelins and daggers and wore on their feet the buskin of their country, which reached halfway up the shank. In the same fashion were equipped the Lygians, the Matanians, the Mariandenians, and the Syrians, or Cappadocians, as they are called by the Persians. The dress of the Phrygians closely resembled the Paphlagonian, Phrygian fashion. The Armenians, who are Phrygian colonists, were armed in the Phrygian fashion. The Lydians were armed very nearly in the Grecian manner. These Lydians in ancient times were called Maeonians, but changed their name and took their present title from Lytus, the son of Attis. The Mysians wore upon their heads a helmet made after the fashion of their country and carried a small buckler. They used as javelins, staves with one end hardened in the fire. The Mysians are Lydian colonists and from the mountain chain of Olympus are called Olympiani. The Thracians went to war wearing the skins of foxes upon their heads, and about their bodies tunics, over which was thrown a long cloak of many colors. Their legs and feet were clad in buskins made from the skins of fawns, and they had for arms javelins, with light targes and short dirks. This people, after crossing into Asia, took the name of Bithynians. Before they had been called Strymonians while they dwelt upon the Strymon, whence, according to their own account, they had been driven out by the Mysians and the Teucrians. The Calybians had small shields made of the hide of the ox, and carried each of them two spears such as are used in wolf hunting. Brazen helmets protected their heads, and above these they wore the ears and horns of an ox fashioned in brass. They had also crests on their helms, and their legs were bound round with purple bands. There is an oracle of Mars in the country of this people. The Cabalians, who are Maeonians, but are called Lasonians, had the same equipment as the Cilicians, an equipment which I shall describe when I come in due course to the Cilician contingent. The Milians bore short spears and had their garments fastened with buckles. Some of their number carried Lycian bows. They wore about their heads skull caps made of leather. The Moschians wore helmets made of wood and carried shields and spears of a small size. Their spearhead, however, were long. The Moschian equipment was that likewise of the Tiberinians, the Macronians, and the Mycenaeans. The mares wore on their heads the plated helmet peculiar to their country and used small leathern bucklers and javelins. The Colchians wore wooden helmets and carried small shields of rawhide and short spears, besides which they had swords. The Alarodians and Sisperians were armed like the Colchians. The islanders who came from the Erythraean Sea, where they inhabited the islands to which the king sends those whom he banishes, wore a dress and arms almost exactly like the Median. Such were the nations who fought upon the dry land and made up the infantry of the Persians. Of all the troops, the Persians were adorned with the greatest magnificence, and they were likewise the most valiant. Besides their arms, which have been already described, They glittered all over with gold, vast quantities of which they wore about their persons. They were followed by litters, whereon rode their concubines, and by a numerous train of attendants handsomely dressed. Camels and sumpter beasts carried their provision, apart from that of the other soldiers. The triremes amounted in all to 1,207, and were furnished by the following nations. The Phoenicians, with the Syrians of Palestine, furnished 300 vessels, the crews of which were thus accounted. Upon their heads they wore helmets made nearly in the Grecian manner. About their bodies they had breastplates of linen. They carried shields without rims and were armed with javelins. The Egyptian furnished 200 ships. Their crews had plated helmets upon their heads and bore concave shields with rims of unusual size. They were armed with spears suited for a sea fight and with huge pole axes. The greater part of them wore breastplates, and all had long cutlasses. The Cyprians furnished 150 ships and were equipped in the following fashion. Their kings had turbans bound about their heads, while the people wore tunics. In other respects, they were clad like the Greeks. They are of various races. Some are sprung from Athens and Salamis, some from Arcadia, some from Cythnus, some from Phoenicia, and a portion, according to their own account, from Ethiopia. The Cilicians furnished 100 ships. The crews wore upon their heads the helmet of their country and carried, instead of shields, light targes made of rawhide. They were clad in woolen tunics and were each armed with 2 javelins and a sword closely resembling the cutlass of the Egyptians. This people bore anciently the name of Hypakians, but took their present title from Cilix, the son of Agenor, a Phoenician. The Pamphylians furnished 30 ships, the crews of which were armed exactly as the Greeks. This nation is descended from those who, on the return from Troy, were dispersed with Amphilochus and Calchas. The Lycians furnished 50 ships. Their crews wore greaves and breastplates, while for arms they had bows of cornel wood, reed arrows without feathers, and javelins. Their outer garment was the skin of a goat, which hung from their shoulders, their headdress, a hat encircled with plumes, and besides their other weapons, they carried daggers and falchions. This people came from Crete, and were once called Termolae. They got the name which they now bear from Lycus, the son of Pandion, and Athenian. The Dorians of Asia furnished 30 ships. They were armed in the Grecian fashion, inasmuch as their forefathers came from the Peloponnese. The Carians furnished 70 ships and were equipped like the Greeks, but carried in addition falchions and daggers. The Ionians furnished 100 ships and were armed like the Greeks. Now these Ionians, during the time that they dwelt in the Peloponnese, and inhabited the land now called Achaia, which was before the arrival of Danaus and Xuthus in the Peloponnese, were called, according to the Greek account, Aegelian Pelasgi, or Pelasgi of the Seashore, but afterward, from Ion, the son of Xuthus, they were called Ionians. The islanders furnished 17 ships and wore arms like the Greeks. They too were a Pelasgian race, who in later times took the name of Ionians for the same reason as those who inhabited the 12 cities founded from Athens. The Aeolians furnished 60 ships and were equipped in the Grecian fashion. They too were anciently called Pelasgians, as the Greeks declare. The Hellespontians from the Pontus, who are colonists of the Ionians and Dorians, furnished 100 ships, the crews of which wore the Grecian armor. This did not include the Abydinians, who stayed in their own country because the king had assigned them the special duty of guarding the bridges. On board of every ship was a band of soldiers, Persians, Medes, or Sakans. Besides the triremes, there was an assemblage of 30 oared and 50 oared galleys of Sicuri, light boats of unusual length, and transports for conveying horses, amounting in all to 3,000. Now when the numbering and marshalling of the host was ended, Xerxes conceived a wish to go himself throughout the forces and with his own eyes behold everything. Accordingly, he traversed the ranks seated in his chariot, and going from nation to nation, made manifold inquiries, while his scribes wrote down the answers, till at last he had passed from end of the whole land army, both the horsemen and likewise the foot. This done, he exchanged his chariot for a Sidonian galley, and seated beneath a golden awning, sailed along the prows of all his vessels, the vessels having now been hauled down and launched into the sea, while he made inquiries again as he had done when he reviewed the land forces and caused the answers to be recorded by his scribes. The captains took their ships to the distance of about 400 feet from the shore, and there lay two with their vessels in a single row, the prows facing the land, and with the fighting men upon the decks accounted as if for war, while the king sailed along in the open space between the ships and the shore, and so reviewed the fleet.